It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, learn who's at most at risk for a stroke and how we can take preventive action to protect ourselves from higher risks. First, when you think of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, what comes to mind? Is it the woods and waterfalls, the small towns, the snow, pasties, beer, hunting? And when it comes to the language, is it something like this?
Not bad. Well, this has got a kick to it, I'll say that. What proof is this, Reuben?
Well, sorry to say there's not a drop of alcohol in it.
Well, it ain't no pasty pie, but I'll tell you what, I could drink me a few of these without looking up and saying hello, eh? Oh, just yeah. What the heck's that old lady of yours got in here?
Our next guest spent a great deal of time studying UP culture and the language spoken by Upers and how they're looked at by outsiders. Catherine Remlinger is a professor of English at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. That's in the Lower Peninsula. She's the author of the book Uper Talk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
Well, we heard that clip from Escanaba in the Moonlight there. Is that a stereotype, or were they fairly close in how they represent the language of the UP?
Well, I would say a little bit of both, partly because, you know, the UP is so large, and even in a small area, not everybody's going to sound alike. So not everybody in the UP sounds that way. A lot of the features that are featured or used in linguistic features in Escanaba and the Moonlight are related to more of what people who might be working class or live in rural areas or areas especially that are influenced by Finnish language contact and other immigrant languages from the late 1800s to the early 1900s.
Now, when we
go ahead, I'm sorry.
When we talk about the UP dialect, as you say, it does vary from place to place and even person to person. But what are some of the common features that you focus on in the book?
Well, one of the things I focus on is how tourism and media have picked up on, a few significant features or noticeable ones, recognizable ones. And then because the media and tourist souvenirs use those features, we come to think of the dialect as limited to those. So, for example, the A, or that you heard in the clip from Escanaba and the Moonlight, the duh for the, or you betcha, or even some of the vowel sounds like we would hear an out and about, for example. So those are some of the features, but not everybody is going to use those or have those in their dialect, and not everybody is going to use them all the time. So context often plays a part of it too, because we naturally change the way we speak depending on where we are and who we're talking with and what we're talking about.
And that's a key to your book, it seems. Language isn't this fixed thing. It changes, and it says something about our identity, who we are as individuals, who we are as a culture, as a region.
Exactly. And that's part of the reason why Escanaba and the Moonlight will use some of those dialect features with their different characters. And if you watch the movie, you'll notice not all characters use them. And the characters who do speak in this stereotypical or iconic Uper talk way, they are the ones featured as being most Uper, right? So the hunters and the people who are local. But the DNR officer, he doesn't have as many of those features as the other characters do. So language, sometimes we're not even aware of it, is our badge of identity and how we use it to identify where we're from and who we are. Could be our religious group or our gender, sexuality, our age, all kinds of different ways.
Over the years, I've heard different ideas of the origins of Uper dialect. Some people have said it's the strong Finnish-American presence there. The A makes people think of Canadian English. But you write that it's really a mix of a lot of different linguistic sources.
Right. And part of that iconic voice, like you hear in Escanaba and the Moonlight, is what you would hear more in the northwestern part of the UP because of the prolonged contact with Finnish. Finnish immigrants were the largest group to immigrate, and they were one of the last. But because Finnish isn't related to English, and some other social reasons, like being ostracized for being Finnish, the Finns kept their language longer than many of the other immigrant groups did. four and five generations, which is rare. Most often, and even today, people will lose their first language after the during the third generation. The second generation might be bilingual, but because of the contact with Finnish, those features of Finnish, for example, the lack of the TH sounds, like in the, gets da. But a lot of languages other than English don't have that sound. So there was influence by German and Norwegian and Swedish and Cornish English. And we might have gotten A from Cornish English. We might have also gotten it from Anishinaabemowin or Ojibwe, because there's a tag question or that end kind of question in that language too. Also, Canadian French has a similar tag question, hien, that sounds somewhat like A. So we're not quite sure where the A came from, but we do know it's this marker of identity in the UP as well as for some Canadians.
Talking to Catherine Remlinger about her new book, Upper Talk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Catherine, when did we first come across this idea of the Upper, as an identity, as a description of someone who lives in this region?
That's interesting, too, because it's relatively new, and partly because the settlement of the UP is relatively recent compared to other parts of the United States, especially the northwestern part. It wasn't until 1842 that copper was discovered there by Douglas Houghton, who was at the time the state geologist for Michigan. Of course, the Anishinaabe had discovered and were using copper and mining it for hundreds, if not thousands, of years before that. But European settlement wasn't until the mid-1800s in the northwestern part of the UP. The eastern part had had easier contact because of the access through the St. Lawrence Seaway and the lakes there, contact with French Canadians and missionaries. But part of it is that the UP, the northwestern part especially, wasn't settled to the 1800s. So the idea of what it means to be from a place took some time to develop. And we don't see the word Upper, in fact, being used in media until the 1970s. Surely it existed before then, because words exist in conversation before they get put in print. But the first evidence we can find of that is from the 1970s.
I'm a troll. I'm from Lower Michigan, below the bridge, and spend a lot of time, as many Michiganders do, as a tourist in the Upper Peninsula. Can you talk about, and you were touching on this earlier, how this identity influenced the way the UP promoted itself and have had kind of a mixed feelings about the tourists who came up across the bridge?
Right. So there's, you know, I think anywhere you go, there are probably tensions between insiders and outsiders. But for the UP, you feel it especially strong. And partly that's because the UP has been seen in great distance and physical distance from the center of Michigan in the state capital in Lansing. It's also separated by a body of water, and it wasn't until 1957 that the Mackinac Bridge was built and connected the two. There were ferries that people could travel easily across. And of course, the land is connected to your state, Wisconsin, now, and that's part of it. But there's also economic differences, and also the UP is often left off of maps of Michigan, and that doesn't always sit well with people who are from the Upper Peninsula. Part of it, too, I think, is that there is a lifestyle in some ways different from the Upper Peninsula and the Lower Peninsula, especially with urban areas. But we see this identity being celebrated in tourist souvenirs. So on coffee mugs or on T-shirts, so saying things like, I know how to pronounce sauna. Or I have a coffee mug that has different terms for different Upper kinds of things. Or I have a magnet that says, I know how to say pasty. It's not pastries. It's not pasties. It's pasties, Upper food of the gods. So telling people how to pronounce things that are local words, for example, are some of the things you would see on tourist souvenirs, and that also promote local identity and what it means to be a Upper.
We're talking about what makes the Upper Peninsula of Michigan what it is with Catherine Remlinger. She's a professor of English at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan, and the author of Uppertalk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you live in the UP or do you spend much time there? What sticks out to you about the language and way of life? Call 800-642-1234. I know we've got a lot of listeners on that side of the border there. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the language and culture of Michigan's Upper Peninsula with Catherine Remlinger. She's a professor of English at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. That's in the Lower Peninsula of the state. She's the author of the book Uppertalk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What comes to mind when you think about the UP? Do you live or have you lived in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan? What do you want people to know about life and language? Do you have a favorite Upper-ism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Kate, before we go to our callers, with any regional dialect, there's the question of whether it's going to stick around. We have this mass media, cable TV is the same everywhere. The internet is the same everywhere. Do we see a dialect like the Upper Peninsula variations disappearing over time?
Well, can't say. I always wish I've had a linguistic crystal ball to tell the future of dialects and languages, but that's not going to happen. But what my crystal ball will tell me right now, that language will change, dialects will change. They're changing right now. They have to, because as society changes, language changes. And the people who live in the UP now aren't the people who lived there in the early 1800s or the mid 1900s. Excuse me. And some of the dialects that evolved from language contact with those immigrant languages like German or Finnish, those speakers don't exist anymore. So when people are saying dialects are dying, really what they're hearing is that they're changing. And some linguists would say that regional and local dialects, ways of speaking, excuse me, are actually getting stronger, but in different ways. So it sounds like they're dying out. And the reason for this would be that how else do we show where we're from or who we are? Language is our badge of identity. Sure, they'll change, but to die completely out, that won't happen. We don't learn how to speak or our dialects from TV or radio. We learn it through people we interact with on a daily basis. And so for that reason, alone, we'll never become this one dialect kind of nation.
Let's bring on our callers now. Deborah is with us in Brown Deer. No, I guess we've got Scott in Oshkosh first. We'll get to you in a minute, Deborah. Scott, hello.
Hello there.
What'd you want to bring up, Scott?
Well, I'm from Texas. I'm an educator. And when I first moved up here to Wisconsin, I noticed there was an excessive use of the word yet, Y-E-T. And it became so prevalent that every time somebody would say the word yet, I would point it out. And grammatically, if I were to write a paper, I would not include so many of the words yet. So I was going to call away with words, but you are the perfect platform.
Okay. And is that like yet instead of the word still? Because I'll do that sometimes, I'm not going to lie. Or is it just kind of a floating word?
It both.
Okay. Scott, thanks. You were laughing there, Kate. Is this a Upperism too?
It's not. And in fact, Joe Salmons at University of Wisconsin probably could tell you a lot more about it. So could folks over at the Dictionary of American Regional English that used to be housed at the University of Wisconsin. Yet is a really good example of influence from German. And that's why you hear it a lot where you are in Wisconsin rather than what you probably heard in Texas. I don't know much about it, except that I do know that it's an influence from German because German has the same kind of features. So, for example, I might say, come here yet, which probably to a Texan or me, even it sounds kind of odd, but I kind of get what it means, right? Maybe for a little bit. I'm but I shouldn't say much more about it. I would say contact Joe over in the University of Wisconsin there in Madison.
Thanks for the call, Scott. We'll go now to Deborah in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hi, I'm a Youper, and I don't remember ever using the term A, but when I think of my friends from Ishpeming and Agani, that is the prevalent, like, word, like, I don't, is that, is A a word? I mean.
Oh, it is a word, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, it should be, even if it's not in the dictionary, but, because it's so meaningful, but I always wonder what we sound, or, and everybody, I mean, what do we sound like to, like, British people, or what does a foreign language sound like to someone else? But growing up there, it was just, it's just an amazing place, and I know you've probably been there, and you know that.
Deborah, thanks. And yeah, I know you went to school in Houghton, Kate, for your undergraduate at Michigan Tech. But talk about that perception, how, say, people who speak the Youper dialect, as Deborah's friends did, when they interact, say, with people from the Lower Peninsula. How do people see those different ways of talking?
Yeah, so I got this idea to do the research when I was actually working on my PhD at Michigan Tech, and I had friends who were local, and we would talk about language and dialects, and I'm originally from Central Ohio, Columbus, and we would talk about how we say things differently. And those friends had moved to Texas for a while, and they said that when they moved to Texas, people thought they were Canadian. And in my interviews with people in the Keweenaw and outlying areas, I asked them that question. So when you've traveled or you've moved to other places, what do people say to you? And most people say, oh, they think we're Canadian. And it's probably that A, but more often it's probably some of the vowel sounds that people hear, and they associate it with sounding Canadian. And in fact, there's another linguist at Grand Valley State University, Will Rankinen, who's studying the vowels. And he has found that the vowel sounds do match more closely to Canadian vowels than what we might think of as Finnish vowels in that kind of way. So that A is part of that, and as well as some of the vowel sounds. You asked about downstate. You know, there's a mix of perceptions, like there might just be anywhere. Some people will think that sounding Youper isn't proper from a linguist standpoint. As long as you're communicating your ideas, there's no such thing as bad English. It's just a different variety, of different way of speaking English. So there's a mixed bag of what people will think. But I think that idea that Youpers sound Canadian is probably pretty pervasive.
Let's go back to our callers. Thanks, Deborah. We've got Nicole with us now in Ironwood, Michigan. Nicole, hello.
Oh, hey there. How's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Nicole?
Hey there. Hey, I'm actually born and raised in Ironwood, Michigan, and I used to be, used to is a big word up there. When I moved to Arizona, I was highly embarrassed of our dialect and figured out that there are some words that don't exist anywhere else on the planet, such as pink. And have you ever heard of the word pink before?
Until I read Kate's book, yeah.
All right. Well, so pink, basically, if you've got a snowbank and you got to take the shovel and, you know, you got to, you know, you just pink it down. It's an action word, which can also refer to the hair on your head when you're wearing a hat and it just gets smashed down. That's another definition of the word pink. But I've had to change my dialect a little bit. One of the words also, it's an obvious one, but bag. I no longer say bag unless I do work on a radio show called the Deer Hunters Roundup once a year. It is a seasonal treat. I'm your camp cook, and we share venison recipes. People call in their deer reports, and yeah, so now I'm acquainted with the language of the dialect, and I get to use that on, you know, basically one of my little career points in life. And
Nicole,
yeah,
thanks so much for the call. There are parts of Wisconsin where you hear bag and bagel, but talk about the pank a little bit, please, Kate.
Great. So pank is really interesting word because, like Nicole said, a lot of people believe that that's a unique word to the UP. But what we find is it's only usually known in places where mining was. And what we found is that the word was probably brought in by miners because we find uses of it when people would talk about, miners would talk about panking blasting powder in a hole when they were doing copper mining. But the Dictionary of American Regional English shows that pank is also used in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and oh, now I'm forgetting the other place, but both of the other places are mining regions. Huh. So there's something with that word that was brought in. It's also related to Norwegian and Swedish and Danish banka, which means to pat down or make compact. And that's the same. So it could have been brought in by those people when they immigrated to the UP, because we had people who immigrated from Norway and Sweden and Denmark. So that word is so unique because people claim it as a UP word, and I think it is a UP word, but it is also used in these other places, and it probably came in through the mining with the miners.
Nicole, thanks for the call. Time for one more call. I think David in Manawa. David, hi.
Hi. I was born in Marquette. I was raised up near Gwin in the woods. I'm 63. I've been an interstate truck driver my whole life, but I've been accused of being a Canadian so many times.
And my
mother used to always say, don't go outside, don't forget your chuck, put your chuck on your head. Well, that's stocking cap. And fin scoop, my uncles would make a fin scoop to do the driveway, you know, and I'd say, well, I drive my wife nuts because she's from Green Bay. I've been married, but I go into the Upertalk dialect here and now, every now and then, and I'll tell you, she's like, I crack her ass up, you know, because she's, you know, and I got three sons.
I got to jump in. I'm sorry, David, we're just about out of time. Kate, some final thoughts about Upertalk past and present, or last minute.
Yeah, David's comments, really excellent example of how other languages influence English there, because chook comes from French Canadian took, a knitwinter cap. So it's a really good example. All of these comments that folks made in with their calls is how language varies in the attitudes that we have with them and how our attitudes affect people. And I think that's something to keep in mind when we don't always like how someone says. It's also saying something about them personally, because our language is that badge of identity, this thing that we show who we are and where we're from and who we're connected with, our families, friends, and communities.
Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob. I really enjoyed talking with you and the callers.
That was Catherine Remlinger, professor of English at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. We talked with her about her book, Upertalk, Dialect as Identity in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Thanks to all our Uper callers and listeners, too. Coming up after the news, we'll look at strokes, a leading cause of death in the United States, and how to prevent them. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Republican lawmakers on the State Building Commission rejected every project Governor Evers included in his $2.5 billion capital budget yesterday. We'll learn more about that vote and what happens next. First, actor Luke Perry passed away aged 52 earlier this month after experiencing a stroke. And closer to home, Milwaukee Talk radio host Mark Belling, at the age of 62, survived what he now knows was a stroke while on the job in February. According to the CDC, about 140,000 Americans die of a stroke each year. That means strokes are at fault for about one out of every 20 deaths. Dr. Heather Johnson is an associate professor in the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She's a preventive cardiologist and a fellow of the American Heart Association. Dr. Johnson, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we mentioned a couple ages there, 52 and 62. When do we tend to be most at risk for stroke?
It's a great question. It used to be that people were more concerned about having strokes later in life, starting middle age to older age groups. What we're seeing, though, are rising rates of stroke actually among younger adults. We see strokes in 30s, 40s, 50-year-old individuals, and it's definitely raising our awareness about the importance of prevention earlier in life.
Do we have an idea of why that is, why we're seeing strokes among younger people?
We're beginning to see higher rates of high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity. And unfortunately, when we think about these factors affecting our body, the amount of years that you're exposed to this raises your risk. So starting to have high blood pressure in your 20s can definitely begin to raise your rate of stroke well before the age of 50 years old.
Now, we mentioned Mark Belling, the radio host in Milwaukee. I want to give a listen to how he describes his experience, because it illustrates we don't always know that we're having a stroke in the moment.
I had this weird sensation going on. It just all of a sudden came on. There was no warning. And people have described this in all sorts of ways. I can only describe to you as that it was sort of painful and it was sort of in my head, but it wasn't, it was not excruciating. It was not debilitating. It was not scream out loud. It was nothing like that, which is one of the reasons why I was a little confused about what was going on.
Mark Belling there on his radio show talking about his experience having a stroke. As I understand it, Dr. Johnson, one of the keys to surviving a stroke is to detect it early and get treatment really fast. That said, it's we may be confused while we're having it. How do we know? How do we figure out if this is what's going on?
Excellent question. So the American Heart Association and the Stroke Association actually recommend using a test called FAST, F-A-S-T, with F standing for face. So if you try and smile and one side is drooping or a little bit slower, A standing for arms, you try and raise both arms. One is unfortunately unable to move or slower. S is for speech. And T is actually time. And I'll get back to time in a second. But the symptoms that were recommended as far as what to look out for is far beyond that too. As far as headaches, it can usually be sudden. It may not be very severe, but it's unusual. It's very unusual. Confusion, you mentioned. Vision changes. Also balance, discoordination. There are multiple factors that play a role, but it's definitely out of the ordinary. The other thing is that stroke symptoms may sometimes be brief. They may be 5 minutes, in which they talk about mini strokes where the symptoms passed. But the interesting thing about it is that time is still important. Call 911. If you see someone having these symptoms, sometimes they're unable to clearly explain what's going on. And that's a key time to just call 911. Time is of the essence.
And I've heard that heart attack symptoms may manifest differently in women than they do in men. Sometimes what we think of as the traditional heart attack symptoms might not apply for women. Is there a similar story when it comes to stroke?
So, great question. In general, stroke symptoms vary between men and women and across individuals. It's tough to say how one particular gender may present. We do know that men tend to be at higher risk for stroke, especially earlier in age. However, we also know that things like tobacco use can significantly raise the stroke in women. But younger age groups typically affect as far as men are more affected during that time with stroke. Yes.
Talking to Dr. Heather Johnson from the UW School of Medicine Public Health about a stroke awareness and prevention. And let's spend the bulk of our time, Dr. Johnson, on that. You've done work on what works for preventing stroke starting at a much earlier age than I would have thought about.
Yes, what we realize is that it's important to start young. So when we talk about young adults, typically less than 50 years old, less than 40 years old is actually key. UW Health has really taken a role as far as focusing on this younger population because, unfortunately, you mentioned heart attacks and also with stroke, we're seeing much higher rates in younger populations. In general, though, regardless of age, managing blood pressure, knowing your blood pressure, getting the numbers down are important. Everyone should know their cholesterol numbers. Also, regular physical activity. Even if you're at your optimal weight, it's still important to stay active. The other thing, too, is there are some things we cannot do as far as change our family history. We can't change as far as growing older each year. Also, ethnicity. African Americans tend to have much higher rates of stroke compared to non-African Americans. So things also we can prevent and control, like diabetes and quitting smoking, make a big difference compared to what we cannot change.
And a nice coincidence there, all those things you just mentioned, I think, are all involved in preventing heart attacks as well.
You're exactly right. It's all part of what we call the cardiovascular system in general. The blood vessels that feed our heart then help support the blood vessels that feed the brain. Prevention is key for both, and time is important for both as far as symptoms.
Are there environmental factors that go into this, things that might be beyond an individual's direct control?
So in general, when we talk about environmental, there are some data out there regarding as far as population exposure and in relationship also to pollution. And those are things we cannot change. But how we manage stress in our environment, though, is a key factor. And those are one of the things that we also talk about. It doesn't necessarily come up all the time during medical visits, but how we manage the stress within our environment is definitely a key benefit as far as protecting our vessels.
I want to bring on a caller now. We've got Dave in Livingston with us. Dave, hello.
Oh, hello to you both. I was just wondering, I had a stroke last year this time, and I wonder, you know, when I talk, sometimes I can't find the right word to fill the sentence in, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. So one of the consequences of a non-fatal stroke can be, as Dave was saying, language difficulties. What are some of the other impacts of surviving a stroke?
So surviving a stroke affects the individual, also family members and significant others. So I thank the caller as far as sharing the experience. And yes, sometimes residual speech difficulty, there may be movement limitations or paralysis in a limb or multiple limbs that are there. Memory difficulty we can sometimes see. Change in baseline mood can definitely be another factor. They're also within the more immediate time surrounding a stroke, there may be significant blood pressure issues, heart rhythm issues. So there are various things that are monitored, and working closely with all the physicians as part of the team is important to follow and make sure things can improve as much as possible. The other thing is that some people do need to participate in rehabilitation after a stroke, and that'll help that individual regain as much quality of life as possible.
Dave, thanks for sharing your experience. Sorry you went through that, and best wishes on your long-term recovery. And Dr. Johnson, we hear after someone's had the first heart attack, what do you do to prevent the next one? How about stroke? Whether you've had a mini stroke or a stroke, what can be done to prevent the next one?
It's a great question. And that is a major focus with us at UW Health, is not just preventing the first event, but the second event, if not sometimes a third event. And what we know is that if you present with a heart attack or stroke, it's a very important time to address all the blood vessels. So it goes back to, what are our risk factors? What can we change? And usually after a heart attack or stroke, there is very close monitoring of blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes. And the biggest thing is that although people may not want to be on certain medications, some of those medications are definitely recommended to help prevent that next event. They actually decrease your risk, not only of an event, but sometimes death after these events. And so working with the team very closely, you may be recommended to cardiac rehab, stroke rehab, as I mentioned. That's important. Also, being active as much as possible, relying on support as far as family, friends, significant others, but paying attention as far as the health risk that unfortunately led to that event is going to be key. It's a lifetime process.
In our last minute or so, Dr. Johnson, can you leave listeners with some advice, just a recap of how to spot that stroke in ourselves or the person we're in a room with and what to do?
Exactly. So remember FAST, F-A-S-T, facial drooping, difficulty raising one or both arms, slurred speech. T is for time. Just call 911. The stroke evaluation begins immediately with the arrival of the ambulance. That determines where you go. It also determines what type of treatment based upon how much time. Other symptoms, confusion, headache, vision changes, those are balance issues. Just don't worry about trying to figure it out. Just call 911.
Dr. Johnson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Heather Johnson, Associate Professor in the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She's a preventive cardiologist and a fellow of the American Heart Association. She joined us to talk about how we can start preventive care against strokes now and how to recognize when someone is experiencing a stroke. Coming up, learn more about yesterday's party line vote by the State Building Commission rejecting all of Governor Evers' building proposals. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from both candidates running for a seat on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. First, In a vote yesterday, Republicans on the State Building Commission rejected all 82 projects in Governor Evers' proposed $2.5 billion capital budget. State Republicans have argued that the governor's budget is unrealistic. Democrats say the vote yesterday was purely political. Our next guest is here to tell us about the vote and what happens next. Plus, we'll take a look at a judge's decision to block laws passed in last December's lame duck session. Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, talk us through what happened in this vote yesterday.
So this vote happened late yesterday afternoon, and essentially it was Republicans on the State Building Commission rejecting the entirety of Governor Tony Evers' capital budget. So for folks that don't know, the capital budget is basically the slate of building projects that the state is going to engage in over the next 2 years. This had quite a few building projects for the University of Wisconsin system, for example. It had a new state office building in Milwaukee, things like that. So Republicans have expressed concern ever since the governor rolled out this capital budget about 2 weeks ago, saying that it's just too expensive. You mentioned it's $2.5 billion. It has $2 billion of borrowing as part of the budget. And so it wasn't entirely unexpected that they voiced some concerns during this building commission meeting last night, but I don't think anyone was expecting necessarily them to vote down every single project individually.
Now that doesn't mean that every single project is dead in the water, never going to happen, right?
That's right. So basically, this is a symbolic vote. All of these projects now move to the state legislature, the legislature's budget committee, where they will be able to be evaluated kind of on a case-by-case basis. Republicans used that argument as part of their sort of debate and discussion last night. They said, we are open to a number of these projects. We think a number of these things are good for our state and very important, but we just fundamentally disagree with the scope of this capital budget. We think it would be irresponsible to enumerate all of these projects. So we really want to send kind of a strong pumping the brakes message and say, hey, we're going to pare this down a little bit before we approve it.
And people have been watching for signs as to whether there could be bipartisan cooperation between Republican leadership in the legislature and the Democratic governor. This looks like a sign that maybe no, not a lot of that.
Well, this is a really big fundamental difference that's on display. Again, we've had several of those since the governor took office just a couple months ago, but this is certainly a major departure in philosophy. You know, this is a very different kind of capital budget than the capital budgets advanced by former Governor Scott Walker. His last capital budget was about $1 billion. This one, as we mentioned, is 2.5, so much larger. Part of the discussion has been, you know, Governor Walker and his capital budgets delayed some things, didn't fund some things that I think Democrats were frustrated with and by. And so this budget is more expansive, obviously, and addresses more of those things. But Republicans just say, as they did about Governor Evers' budget proposal, frankly, that it's just too much and too expensive and goes too far.
So what's the timeline for what happens next then with this capital budget, this building budget?
So this is all going to go to the Joint Finance Committee, and I believe it's on the same kind of timeline as the state budget. So we're looking at a matter of months here to meet deadlines and, you know, get these projects moving forward.
Talking to Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, that capital budget was the big story in Wisconsin government and politics until today. And a judge ruled against the lame duck session of the legislature last month. There's a few different lawsuits here. This is the lawsuit, as I understand it, that basically says that session never happened. It wasn't in accordance with law, and everything that they did is void. It's gone, and a judge agreed with the plaintiffs here, right?
That's right. So this is definitely the big news of today. This is a Dane County judge that ruled that essentially the entire extraordinary session from last December was null and void, and he returned all of the powers that had been stripped from Governor Evers back to him. The biggest of those, one that we talked an awful lot about, was something that the governor talked about on his campaign, which was withdrawing Wisconsin from a federal, multi-state federal lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. So So as of the judge's decision this morning, late this morning, the governor has the power to do that. He acted on it very quickly. He's already instructed the state attorney general to remove Wisconsin from that lawsuit, and the attorney general says he's working on it. So we certainly have some things to keep an eye on. Aside from that, the governor had a number of other things taken away from him during the lame duck legislative session, of course, but the lame duck session also approved a number of appointments that Governor Scott Walker made before he left office, more than 80 appointments, actually. So as of today and as of this judge's ruling, all of those individuals have been stripped of their jobs, and those positions are vacant.
We'll dig into that a little more in a bit, Laurel, but I assume this is not necessarily the last word Republicans, I'm guessing, are going to appeal this thing?
Absolutely. They've already said they're planning to appeal this, so we'll be looking for that in terms of, you know, next steps and how quickly that appeal is going to happen.
And what have Republicans been saying as far as their political response to this ruling from a judge, as you mentioned, in Dane County?
So this is something that Republican lawmakers talk quite a bit about liberal activist judges in Dane County. They don't really think that their actions are fairly evaluated here. So, you know, when they appeal this ruling, I think their messaging is that they're optimistic that their actions will be held up on appeal. Now, conversely, the governor just spoke with reporters a couple hours ago and says he's confident that the appeal will hold up the Dane County judge's ruling. So we've got strong optimism on either side about the way this is going to go on appeal.
An important question, I guess, in the appeals process, was this a court in the state court system or in the federal court system?
This is within the state court system.
So the final word, if this keeps going up the pipeline, would be with the state's Supreme Court.
That's right, which currently has a conservative majority.
And potentially the April 2nd election might bring somebody into office at the court who would be voting on this thing in a month or two.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about this kind of limbo situation we're in now. As you mentioned, 82 appointments have been de-appointed, in effect, by this court decision. Is there an indication from Governor Evers that he's going to start making appointments to things like, I think, the UW Board of Regents, various commissions, and more?
Mm-hmm. Another big one is an appointee to the Public Service Commission that the governor appointed right before he left office. You know, we asked Governor Evers, what are you going to do next? What are, you know, how quickly are you going to move on these things? And he said that he's really comfortable and his office is pretty comfortable with this being upheld on appeal. So he said, we don't feel like we have a tight window of time to work here. We want to kind of approach these things responsibly, take our time, evaluate what we have the power to do and what we want to do with it. He said those appointments are certainly part of that calculus and something that they're going to be looking at. But the message from the governor this afternoon definitely wasn't, we're going to be making appointments quickly or we're going to be taking any other actions quickly. The only thing he's done today has to do with that Affordable Care Act lawsuit.
And this was, the challenge was over the constitutionality of this extraordinary session of the legislature. It's not in the state constitution or law, but it is in the rules of the legislature, as I understand this. There have been these extraordinary sessions before, these self-convened sessions. Does this mean potentially that we're going to start looking at these older extraordinary sessions? I know that wasn't, the judge didn't rule on those in particular.
Right. So in his decision, Judge Richard Neese said that other extraordinary sessions weren't under the purview of his ruling. So he said, I'm just looking at December 2018 because the argument during the case had been if you throw out the December 2018 extraordinary session, you're going to be throwing out all these other extraordinary sessions. And the judge said, no, I don't believe that that's a pertinent argument. I don't agree with that. So as of right now, no other extraordinary sessions are affected by this ruling. There have been about 24 extraordinary sessions, I believe, in Wisconsin history since about 1980. These are times that the legislature calls itself into session when it's not previously scheduled.
And briefly, Laurel, what are you watching for next now on this whole saga?
Well, we're certainly going to keep an eye on when, you know, the appeal is filed, when arguments for that are going to be taking place. And then we do, of course, have a handful of other lame duck lawsuits, one of which has arguments on Monday. So we're just keeping an eye on all of this moving lame duck legal action.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Laurel White, State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joined us to talk about state Republicans rejecting Governor Evers' capital budget plan and a judge's decision to block laws passed during December's lame duck session. As you heard, an appeal there is likely. You could read more about both of those stories. We have items up at WPR.org. Click on the news link there, and you could see information about those and other big stories in Wisconsin news and politics. That's over at WPR.org. If you're a big fan of the comic strip cat Garfield, you can finally live your dream and eat in a Garfield-themed restaurant. It's a bit of a drive. It's opening up in Toronto, and it's geared toward delivery and takeout orders. It'll feature Garfuccino coffee drinks, Garfield-shaped pizzas, and, of course, lasagna and Garfield-related enhanced reality games. Bill Martin's in the studio with me. You started celebrating right away, right? Did I understand you had some lasagna in your lunch today?
I did. I had some leftover lasagna. It was really good. I actually had a cat that would eat lasagna and pizza as well. So, but this one was all mine.
The cat was all yours, or the lasagna?
The lasagna
didn't have to share
it
with
mine.
The cat. Okay,
correct.
Fair. Now, were you a Garfield fan? Are you a Garfield fan?
Yeah, you know, I really like the holiday ones, the Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas.
The TV versions.
Right, exactly. And we still even watch those on DVD every year.
Really?
Yeah.
On the related holiday?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
But how about the comic strip? I was into it as a kid. I remember I had a couple of the collections.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do as much for me now, I'll admit.
I haven't actually looked at a Garfield comic strip in a long time, but I liked him when, you know, growing up, we had a cat, and, you know, I thought that he kind of captured some of the funny things that cats do relatively well.
Okay, now how about this? Your water dispenser at your Garfield-themed restaurant, it's like Odie is drooling into your glass. How about that?
Is that for real?
You guys can have, no, I'm making it up, but they can have that idea for free.
Wow,
yeah,
thanks.
I'd go check that out.
Great.
And are you, next time you're in Toronto, if ever, Bill, will you check this restaurant
yeah,
out?
Yeah, if I'm there. I don't know if I'd go out of my way to go all the way to Toronto and check it out, but if I'm nearby, sure.
All right, and share some of that lasagna with me tomorrow. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.